are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. Christmas is over for another year, and on this episode, we are bringing you three exciting interviews with Brighton writers to help inspire your reading and your writing in 2023. I talk to P.D. Viner about his crime thrillers and his community-based writing routine. I speak to author of Ridley Road, Jo Bloom, about her new book called Permission, which explores non-monogamy in a long-term marriage. And I speak to writer, podcaster and all-around Brighton man about town, David Bramwell, about all his exciting projects, including his books, his podcasts and the live events that he runs every month at Latest Music Bar. Our book club book this month is Women's Prize Longlisted, The Final Revival of Opal and Nev by Dawnie Walton, which was recommended in our previous Christmas recommendation episode by Elizabeth Perry. I discuss this book at the end of the show. The Brighton Book Club is also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you download yours. Enjoy the show. Brighton-based writer P.D. Viner is the author of five novels and most recently thrillers The Call and The Choice, which are out now with Hera Books. P.D. Viner, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you very much, Anna. It's lovely to see you.
So let's start from the beginning. When did you start writing and how did you get from there to an author with five novels under your belt?
So when did I start writing? I mean, I started writing when I was a kid. So I had a theatre company when I was 15 and we did comedy shows, my favourite of which was I Spit on Santa's Grave. And then the year after we did Santa's Chainsaw Massacre as Christmas shows, and they were mostly sort of sketch comedy shows with a running thriller through it, and then a couple of local stand-up comics. So one year Jeremy Hardy was our guest. We ran it at a local youth theatre. So I started writing then, and film was my first love. I went to film school. I wrote a series of films that I made, and I wrote a number of plays. And then I ran away for some years and lived in America and then in Russia. And I was writing predominantly film scripts, but I wrote two novels when I was in America, which nobody wanted. And then it was when I had my daughter. My wife's got a proper job, so she was at work. So I was the house husband. And I thought, well, I'm going to start writing again properly. So this was 2011. And I was really lucky. I got a book deal in 2013 and 2014 for my first novels, The Last Winter of Danny Lansing and Summer of Ghosts. And then I spent two fun years, but eminently unprofitable, writing the TV show of that first novel, Danny Lansing, which Warner Brothers had put a lot of money into and never saw the light of day. But I got paid for it, and I had lots of really great conference calls with directors and producers in America. And then I started writing new things and got the deal for The Choice and for The Call, which came out in this last year.
So one thing I really like to do is to ask writers with multiple books under their belts for their elevator pitches on each one. So if I read out the titles of your books,
okay,
how do you feel about pitching them to me?
I'll give it a go.
Okay, let's start with The Last Winter of Danny Lansing.
The Last Winter of Danny Lansing is 20 years after their daughter was murdered, an ex-crime journalist and her husband are still haunted by her loss. They believe they've found the man responsible, but when they question him, he dies of a heart attack. What do they do now?
Very good. I am gripped. Okay, let's go on to Summer of Ghosts.
Summer of Ghosts, lifelong drug dealer and criminal, has a secret daughter. He wants out so he can spend some time with his family, but they won't let him out. They find his daughter and murder her, and now he's out for revenge.
Phil, you seem like such a nice bloke, but these books are so dark. Okay, how about The Sad Man?
The Sad Man, he is a young detective whose girlfriend had been murdered, which is why he becomes a policeman. And the day he heard she was dead, his face froze and he aged like 40 years. So he looks like a very sad man. And he wants to start a sex crimes unit in the police, but they won't let him until he solves this serial killer crime. And then they let him open his own sex crimes unit.
Wow. Okay. So moving on to The Call.
The Call, at midnight, a husband is woken up by his wife and she says, please come, please help me. I've killed a man. He gets there. She wants him to bring her towels, bleach, bin bags, a knife and a hammer. When he gets there, there is a beautiful naked young man lying dead. She says it's an accident, but it's obviously an affair. Over 8 hours, they have to get rid of the body and all of the lies and secrets of their marriage come out over one night. By the end of that night, the book starts at midnight, ends at 8 a.m. Will they still be together? Will one of them have killed the other? Will they both be caught by the criminals? And it just gets worse and worse and worse.
Jeez, I'm sweating. Okay, how about your most recent book, which came out in October, called The Choice?
The Choice. So it starts with a couple, Theo and Sarah. They're on their first weekend away. They make love for the first time. And then half an hour later, she has stabbed him through the heart. She says it's not her fault. The police are knocking on the door and the windows are barred, the door is locked. How does she get away and prove her innocence?
Have you ever written a book without murder in it?
Yeah, I've written a kid's book. Nobody wanted it. Obviously, not enough murders. No, I've written the two that I wrote when I was in my 20s were both comedies. And nobody wanted them. Last Winter of Danny Lansing, I wanted to write about loss and grief and the idea of this couple who for 20 years have just been stuck cycling in this sense of loss and grief because they didn't understand what had happened to their daughter. And that was what drew me in. And then once I finished writing it, people said, well, that's a crime novel. And I found an agent and he said, I'll sign you, but only if you're a crime writer. Are you going to write me more crime novels? And I said, all right, then. So I became a crime writer. But I'm really interested in grief and loss and memory and how time distorts how we think of things. But also, I want them to be sort of quirky and quite clever. So the idea of setting myself writing something that starts at midnight and ends at 8 a.m. and just moves forward, doesn't go backwards at all. I really, you know, that was really interesting. And the locked room murder at the start of The Choice, you know, it really is just like, if you set yourself a really great puzzle and then solve it, and then other things just come from that and it just flows and flows. I will read you a section from The Choice. If you promise not to scream or call out, I will remove your gag. Do you understand me? He asks and I nod. Jean leans in to undo the fabric gag. I can smell his breath, strong mints that mask a base scent of sweet decaying cigarettes. Don't scream, he tells me in a low whisper. I wouldn't be able to stop him if you do. And he angles his head ever so slightly to indicate his brother Michael, who frowns. His mouth puckers and the white scars gather like a thread's been pulled together. He looks like a shark. I feel a river of sweat run down my neck and onto my spine. Okay, then. Jean pulls a chair over so he can sit down opposite me. My brother and I were friends of your husband, he tells me. Your dead husband, Michael adds. Yeah, and we are sorry for your loss, Jean says, seriously, though, there is a giggle that breaks from the broken mouth of Michael. It makes me think there's no real sympathy here. We had entered into an agreement with him, and an arrangement with Andrew. What do you mean arrangement? I asked, trying to keep any fear out of my voice. He didn't tell you about us. No, he didn't say anything about you, either of you. I can feel my whole body shake. The two men steal a glance at each other. There is anger and disappointment. But there's suddenly something else in the older man's eyes. It looks like a sudden sharp fear has hit him, that maybe he's wrong. Then I see his eyes darken and he looks back to me.
That is so exciting and so gripping. Thank you so much. So what would you say your top tips are for writing a thriller?
I think before you write anything, you really need to know where your book's going, what it's doing, what the plot is. More than other types of fiction, a thriller really does need a very strong plot. The mechanics need to really hold together. And I think that you need to get that right. I use large boards and post-it notes, and I write the beats of each scene and I put them and run post-it notes, and then I can move them if I need to. And when I'm really happy that the story hangs together, then I think about the way in which I want to tell it. So with the call, because it's a couple, it goes from one perspective to the other. So it goes from Ben to Mia, Ben to Mia. And that way you get the anger at each other, but you also get to be inside both of their heads, because they've both got different agendas and you have to weigh those up. And the hope is that at the start, it's very hard to like Mia because she's done some terrible things. She's making the running. But what I want to happen is that you understand, as the book goes on, from her perspective, why she's made these choices. And there are lots of things that you don't know right at the start. So you need to know as a writer how you want those beats to work. And you need to know what your hook is, what you're selling. You need to be able to do your elevator pitch. Because if it's really clear to you how this works, then it will be clear to the reader as well. And to write characters that you love writing about. They don't have to be likable, but they need to, within their own world, exist and be believable, and that you really like spending time with them and inhabiting their body. Because writing is like putting on somebody else's skin and a persona. You become an actor, you are creating these characters. And so I really do think story comes first, characters develop as the story permits, and that you really don't jump into it writing and getting lost. Really know exactly where you're going. You know, when I'm talking to young writers and novice writers, that's what I say first of all.
So you are a crime writer in Brighton, and we've got a thriving crime and thriller community here.
Absolutely. You know,
from Ellie Griffiths to Jack Jordan to Dorothy Coomson. What is it like to be a writer in Brighton? Where are your favourite places to write? And how is it to be part of this community?
So there is a really strong group called Beachhead Writers, and we've been meeting before the pandemic more often. And we're just sort of getting back into meeting two or three times a year. But 5 or 6 years ago, I set up a small support group. So I meet with 6 or 7 writers every month, and we just talk about writing. We set ourselves goals. We're not sharing our writing, but we are just talking about the hurdles, the pitfalls. And that's really good to have such a strong community. And then how I write now, I used to sit in coffee shops, but the pandemic ended that. So I now have Shut Up and Writes. So I've got a big kitchen table, and up to sort of 7 or 8 writers come here twice a week. I make a big pot of soup and some bread, and we write for an hour, have a coffee, write for an hour, have lunch, write for an hour, have a coffee, write for an hour. So I'll get 4 or 5 hours done twice a week. And that way I can get 10 to 12,000 words a week. And the rest of the time I am plotting what those 2 days are going to be, working on the plot card so that I'm really confident of what I'm doing. And I just find, if it's just me at home, or even if it's just me in a coffee shop, I can faff around, I'll go on the internet, I'll just find so many ways to procrastinate. But if there's another writer sitting there working, it really sharpens my focus. So, and when I was first getting out in writing, I had a writing partner and we used to throw things together, which is fabulous. So having another writer, and if you are lost for something or fancy bouncing an idea off, you can just throw something out, and it's great. So that is my writing week, is as much as possible writing with other writers. And it doesn't have to be crime writers at all. There are, I think in the group there are 3 crime writers, but my wife joins in. She's an academic writer and sort of popular science writer, and other academics will come, and some you know, literary writers, some women's literary writers. It's just great to actually write with other writers, because it's a lonely job otherwise, and it is really often very difficult to think, okay, I'm going to do 4, 5, 6 hours of writing and force the muse to come, rather than just airily waft around thinking, oh, I will work this out today.
Thank you so much for coming on, Phil. How can we find and follow you?
So I am on Twitter at Phil Viner. I have a website at pdviner.com. I am on Instagram, although I am very lazy about posting on it. So yeah, those are the 2 main ways. Oh, and there's Facebook as well. PD Viner, which has got news on. And also, I often just walk around outside, so you can just stop me in the street and say, how are you doing?
It feels mad that I haven't had David Bramwell on the Brighton Book Club before. David is prolific in Brighton, who has been described as a one-man cottage industry. He is a musician, writer, broadcaster, and man about Hanover. David Bramwell, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you, Anna. We should probably qualify for listeners outside of Brighton. That's Hanover in Brighton rather than in Germany.
I didn't even know there was a Hanover in Germany. But yes, for anyone listening, we are definitely not in Germany. We are sitting in my flat. So, David, we've got lots to cover today, and I want to start with your books. Let's start with The Cheeky Guides.
Well, it was 1999 when I went to Amsterdam with a ex-partner of mine, and we found this guidebook called The Cool Guide to Amsterdam, written by an American expat living there. And it was a guidebook. It was a guidebook the like of which I'd not seen before. It wasn't like a rough guide or a time out. It was written, it was very anecdotal, very chatty, very personable. And it told us about this, you know, the world's only toothbrush museum was behind this building over here. There's a barge with this old Chinese guy with about 60 cats. You can go and visit him, have a cup of tea, but don't stroke the white one. It's called Schizo for a... it's called Psycho for a good reason. And I thought, I like this. I like this approach to guidebook writing. It's, you know, it's showing me the corners of a city that I wouldn't normally have gone to. And also people as well. It was very much connecting people. And so it inspired us to have a go at writing a Brighton guidebook. There wasn't one at the time, not then. And we had no experience of publishing, no experience of writing, I had a degree in maths and geography, which has never served me, and I was never that interested in it. I was sort of funneled into science as a kid, and wasn't allowed to do English at school. I was taken aside by the head of English in the school and said, "Bramwell, you won't be doing English A-level." And I said, "Well, I was thinking about it." And he went, "No, you won't be doing." I said, "Oh, I see. Okay." So my behaviour had not been so great for what was then O-level. English, and I think it pissed them off. They got an A, so it was like, right, you're not coming in. So I, there was never any opportunities with English and writing. It was always an interest, but I wouldn't say that I certainly didn't have very good skills in terms of how to write or how to spell. We learned the hard way with those guidebooks in the early years, with getting letters from people pointing a few basics out. So we divided up. We met a man in the street called Jeremy, who was Canadian. We didn't hold it against him. We created a trio. And set up Cheeky Guides Limited and just blundered our way through it. We didn't know what you could and couldn't do, so we just did what we thought was the best thing to do, and thought it'd be funny to have chapters of the book like Where to Contact the Dead, where we reviewed seances and spiritual churches. We had a celebrity spotter's guide and a local eccentric spotter's guide that were irreverent, but also we tried to be respectful. We were not going to say this celebrity lives in this house, that would be a rotten thing to do. But, you know, if you're hanging around in Waitrose, you know, you might see Nick Cave, or you would have done back in the day, you know, that kind of thing. And the book was, yeah, we blundered our way through, and the book was a success. And that was the beginning of my writing career. Didn't really know what we were doing, other than having this idea that it would have a bit of, it would look a bit like a scrapbook, and that it would be written with what we hoped was humour, and really celebrate the people of Brighton as well as the places. And that continued. We did a book for Oxford. I'd lived there on the dole for a year, so knew the city fairly well, and went back for a year to get to know it and to co-write that book with a couple of friends. And then we did a student guide, and then a guide to love. The guide to love was a disaster. We realised that... that right, not because of the subject, I think, but because we realised as a very small company, as an independent publishing company, that if you're going to do a book which you're going to depend on national sales and publicity for it, otherwise it's going to be hidden away as it was on the psychology or humour sections of bookshops, then yeah, you've got to have some muscle behind you to promote these books. Because with Oxford and Brighton, we had I think 42 stockists, you know, in our heyday. And that was amazing, you know, from video rental places, you know, to all of the bookshops. We used to have lots of bookshops and lots of other places. You know, we'd think about how many places in Kent Town have we got? Right, three. Brilliant. And so, yeah, we learned the hard way that something that was written, a subject or, you know, the student guide was okay, but it sold pretty well, but didn't make us any money. So we were ambitious and probably over-ambitious.
After the Cheeky Guides, that didn't stop you from writing and publishing. And when you first came on my radar, although actually I'd been seeing the Cheeky Guides for years, but I hadn't seen two and two together, was the number 9 Bus to Utopia, which came out with Unbound. Let's talk about this book, because I absolutely loved it.
Thank you. I'm still rolling it out as a talk, as a show. I did it in a Skittle Alley in Dorset only 2 days ago. So it's still, you know, it's still got some muscle to it. Life doesn't get any better than it. I actually love doing those kind of gigs. It was sold out, which was great. But yeah, playing this remote pub in Dorset in a Skittle Alley, that was a first. So the number 9 Bus to Utopia was, I think it was. That decision after doing the guides and the public Cheeky Guides were still going, but more a bit sort of quieter in the background by the early noughties, by the late noughties, early whatever the next decade, we never worked out, did we? The tensies.
These ones, the weird ones that we don't like to talk about.
Well, we can do that. We're 20. At least we're in the 20s. It's the one before. Anyway, so I went on a journey for a year, visiting alternative communities, and partly with the intention of doing this as a book, thinking I got myself an agent, I got a nice agent, took the idea to him, he liked it, and so did the classic thing of you know, it was a sort of transitioning from guidebooks to being a travel writer, sort of philosophical humour kind of angle on it, and came back, wrote it up, spent 6 months writing up the book, realised just how miserable it is actually to write a book in isolation like that. Compared, you know, a guidebook's different. You spend the day out wandering around the streets, go to the pub, go to a club, meet people, chat, make notes, come home, write it up. Next day, just like, I love that. And having all the adventures for the number nine, which was a book, yeah, looking at how alternative communities might be able to give us some of the answers to the problems we have with our lives, you know, with the loneliness and isolation in modern life, and particularly in our cities.
So before we move on to Adventures in Newtopia, which is this wonderful podcast that you've been working on, I would like you to quickly talk about your book, The Haunted Moustache, which is another absolutely fascinating prospect that came from Brighton's cultural history.
It did. And this was, so number nine, Bus to Utopia, ended up going out on Unbound. So I had that experience of working with a publishing company where you fundraise, you know, for the book. And that is like pulling teeth. Really lovely company to work with. I mean, brilliant team of people, but I didn't ever want to go back to that. With Haunted Moustache, this was based, both number nine, Bus to Utopia and Haunted Moustache started life as monologues before they became fully fleshed out as books. And the Haunted Moustache was based on a 10-year period in Brighton where I landed here in 1991 and just kind of soaked up the whole underbelly counterculture of the city, going to seances and spiritual churches, joining a cult, drinking ayahuasca, and going in search of the person who was behind a family heirloom, which was a moustache that had been removed, cut off from someone's face, and put in a box and bequeathed to me by my great aunt Sylvia, and I didn't know why, and I didn't know whose moustache it was, and I found out it was a Victorian Freak Show host called Ambrose Oddfellow, but which didn't answer the question as to why Aunt Sylvia ended up with this and why she'd left it to me. So it was a journey that I went on, and so that was, yeah, and that was, of all the things I've done in publishing, it's the book I've been the happiest with, and surprise, surprise, it's because it's one that essentially was a self-published book. So we did it through Cheeky Guide, so we already had the distribution set up and all the infrastructure set up, which was great, but there wasn't anybody saying, you can't put that on the cover, you can't write that, you can't have that picture. So the way the book was designed, the money that was spent on the book, so it was hardback, it was two colour inside, you know, we spent money on the images that we wanted, and, you know, pay for someone to do the layout and template design, and then we embellished that. It was just a joy from start to finish, and yeah.
There's so much about what you do that just like screams autonomy to me. And I am such a advocate for people kind of releasing their own music and films and books, because I just think that it can be so easy to be creatively suppressed once really kind of money and spreadsheets and investments and investors come into it. What is it about producing work yourself that kind of really fuels you?
That fuels me? I think for all the reasons you've said. I like working with a team. I've really enjoyed in the past working with editors, working with designers, working on stage productions when we did stage productions of the Cheeky Guide to Brighton and other things. I really like that. But you know, you hit the nail on the head. I remember only recently approaching a publishing company and saying, I'm thinking of I've got this idea for a book. Are you interested? And he said, yeah, it's the kind of thing that we definitely publish. It's going to be at least 2 years. You know, we've got a 2-year backlog, and, you know, there's no money, there's no advance in this. And, you know, so then, you know, you think to yourself, well, what am I getting? I'm getting the book, it's a strange attractor, the publishing company, who I really like, and I like Mark, who runs it. The books always look fantastic. But, you know, the question for me, what am I gaining? I'm not really sure what I'm gaining. So you're right about that autonomy, having... I think if you're the kind of person that is all right at completing things, I know there's a lot of people out there who struggle with completion, and I, for whatever reason, I'm blessed and also cursed in a way, but with the need to complete things. Yeah. So if I get it in my head that I want to do something, then I will make sure it's done because I want to see it finished, and I want the pleasure of feeling that I've done something to the best of my ability. In 2021, last year, it was the 20th anniversary of my band, and I made an announcement through our band camp and mail out that would be releasing three albums that year. so we did. Wow. One of them was a bit of a cheat because it was an instrumental version of the previous album where I'd taken my voice off. But we did release three albums, and you know, I enjoyed the challenge of that, and I didn't feel there was any compromise around quality. So it's, yeah, I've been very lucky for much of the time that I lived in Brighton. For the first 20 years in Brighton, I had a part-time teaching job, and it was only like one or two days a week, so it didn't pay very much, but it was just enough to get by on. And if you was teaching music, so there wasn't a huge amount of paperwork and bullshit, not in the early days anyway. And so that I had a lot of free time. I had free time to be able to pursue things like my writing, doing live events, doing music, without that worry, too much of a worry of like, well, if this doesn't make money, what am I going to do? That, you know, that's a very, very lucky position to be in.
Absolutely, and not something that a lot of people find now in the climate.
Unless they've got very rich parents. Or, you know, as we see in the papers, you know, like the percentage of people coming from working class backgrounds who are, you know, who are the creatives these days, it's unsurprising.
Let's move on to Adventures in Newtopia. If you are listening to this, you are likely a fan of the audio format, either in radio or podcasts. And I really recommend Adventures in Newtopia. Not only is it fascinating, but it is beautifully and dangerously well produced. And I'm very jealous of your skills, David. So let's talk about how you brought this from idea to fruition.
Thank you. I'll do a little bit of backstory on podcasting and broadcasting. I was lucky to get involved with broadcasting with the BBC for about 10 years. Came about by chance because a friend had asked me to be a talking head for a documentary that he was making at the time, back in 2008, I think. And I just said to the producer, how do you get into the BBC? It's like, I don't know anybody there. And yeah, I didn't go to Oxbridge. And she said, well, if you've got any ideas, then you know, she was very open. And I don't think it's always the case that I was lucky to stumble upon someone who made that invitation. So I think over 2 years, I was just pitching ideas, going, is this any good? Is this any good? And she'd steer me into, like, this is what a proposal should look like, and this is going to work, and this isn't going to work. And the first thing we did was The Haunted Moustache. We did that as an audio piece. And we were going to do, actually, a live ayahuasca drinking ceremony. The first time an illegal psychedelic drug ceremony would have been done on radio, and at the last minute they got cold feet and they bottled, so we didn't do that. But we got the commission, and that led me into that slowly led me over the years into podcasting. I love audio. Mm. I think it's my favourite medium for self-expression. And I guess because I'm a musician, I like to write, but I don't particularly love, you know, the act of just sitting down hunched over a laptop writing. Instead, I like being hunched over a laptop with a microphone instead.
Yourself, yeah.
It's the same, isn't it? Yeah, I realise that. But there's something, I don't know, I think I find it more creative. So I've made quite a few podcast series over the years. I was lucky to work with the author, John Higgs, and we made a four-part documentary series for his book, Wattling Street, which that really helped in shaping the knowledge and skills that I've got for Adventures in Newtopia. And this was rejected three times by the Arts Council, and I was lucky to get funding from the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids, who actually, I should be wearing it now, they had a t-shirt made for me that says sponsored by Druids. So I am, normally people can say they're sponsored by Druids, but they are the principal funders of Adventures in Newtopia, which is a six-part documentary series, which needs to be listened to sequentially, and it is exploring future narratives and kind of big ideas for how we might get ourselves out of the mess and crises that we've got ourselves into, but done, I hope, with a lightness of touch and with humour and with some great guests and documentary style, not just conversations. And it covers themes from agroecology to alternative approaches to medicine, the resurgence of interest in ritual and pilgrimage, Robert Anton Wilson, the counterculture philosopher, his ideas around reality tunnels and why we should be teaching that in education, that we all inhabit a reality of our own creation. And the first episode, New Myths to Live By, explores the myths, particularly the myths of science and religion that brought us to where we are now, and the myths, the stories that people are writing now that might get us out. You know, there's some really amazing ideas out there, and they're not getting out. you know, we spend a lot of our time just sitting around bemoaning the fact that capitalism is destroying us, which it is, and we know that it's no longer fit for purpose, if it ever was as a system. But people say, well, what do we do? Is it capitalism or nothing? No, there's some brilliant stuff out there, from donut economics to ecological civilization. You know, there's some good movements, and I think they're growing. So that there's a passion in, hopefully you can hear that in my voice, you know, passion for this stuff, and loads of great people with ideas to be shared.
Well, I mean, there's nothing else I can add to that. That's a wonderful pitch. And you can listen to Adventures in Utopia from wherever you get your podcasts. One thing I'd like to ask you, David, before we leave you on the show, is you are a kind of scholar in Brighton and Brighton history. What is your favourite tidbit about Brighton that you've learned over the years?
Oh, blimey. Favourite tidbit. Do you know what?
What about something about the underground tunnels by the Pavilion? I'm just fascinated by them.
Well, I don't. I mean, only the fact that there are two tunnels, aren't they, leading into Prince Regent's bedroom. Mm-hmm. So there was one for Mrs. Fitzherbert, but the other one was food delivery. So he was like, as you know, you got one on the left for your mistress, and the other for pizza delivery guy. And you know, if you get drunk and they get in the wrong tunnels, then you, who knows what would happen, you know, with the lights out at the end of the night. Classic Brighton. I love the fact that Brighton is a town where if somebody said to you, oh, you know Merlin, in any other town, people would either say yes or no. Brighton's the only town where someone would go, which Merlin, right?
Yeah.
And I've had that happen to me on several occasions. I love the fact that Brighton is a town where there are two spiritual churches, and they've now joined forces. So there's now just the one spiritual church on Edward Street. That is still going, and I occasionally drop in on a Sunday. This isn't a fact about Brighton, but this is an experience about Brighton. Myself and my partner got up one Monday morning about 3 or 4 years ago and decided that it was quite a nice day. We'd go for a walk, an early walk before she went to work. So we just wandered down to the seafront, and it was about 7:20, typical Monday morning in Brighton, and there's a little group of people gathering by the pier, and we could see a film crew, and we say, what's going on? It's 7:20 in the morning, what's going on? And someone says, oh, it's the world jetpack speed speed race attempt. Yeah, it's like, you know, it's guys trying to beat the jetpack record of, like, you know, 90 miles an hour in a jetpack. And it's like, all right, okay, I might stick around for that. So we get onto the pier, and there's four guys. It's all guys. Of course it's guys. And the millionaire guy, you know, kind of Britain's answer to Elon Musk, whatever, is the one who sort of funded all the money into this. Yeah, yeah. And all these teenagers are hanging around going, oh my God, this is amazing. And then, you know, and these four guys just suddenly ascend and then vroom, shoot over the pier and out to sea. And you're thinking, I just came for a walk on a Monday morning, and this is what I see in Brighton. I love this town.
Thank you so much for coming on, David. How can we find and follow you and listen to Adventures in Utopia?
Well, Adventures in Utopia is on Spotify and Apple and all podcast platforms. And I am drbramwell.com. That's the website, Dr. Bramwell. And Twitter, I'm also at Dr. Bramwell, Dr. Bramwell.
I am joined in the Brighton Book Club studio by Joe Bloom, who is a Brighton-based author of two novels. The first one, Ridley Road, was adapted for TV and out a few years ago, and her new book, Permission, is out now. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Joe.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us about your career as a writer so far.
So I started writing in earnest probably when I came to Brighton, which was about 23 years ago, and part of the reason was coming to Brighton was to dedicate more time to writing and less time to sort of, you know, schlepping all around London. I had a PR, small, you know, self-employed PR in the arts company, and I just decided come down here and free up some time, and then I started writing. I wrote one contemporary novel that got an agent, but then it didn't go anywhere, so I then changed agents and then kind of found the Ridley Road story and started writing that, and then got that deal. And then wrote another historical novel, which I haven't quite finished. And then wrote a contemporary novel, Permission, which is out now.
So let's just pop back to Ridley Road. So this was adapted to the TV, which is wonderful. I'd love to know a bit about your experience of that, how it felt to see your words on screen.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, it was quite a long gestation because the book came out in 2014 and it was optioned really quickly. But then the development, you know, it's a really long process. So it actually was aired, it aired last year in October 2021. And so that's kind of 7 years in the making. So at first, you know, you have to work with them. I worked with Sarah Soleimani, who's an actress, and she actually adapted it. And Red Productions, who have done loads of things like Happy Valley, Last Tango in Paris. Is it Last Tango in Paris?
Halifax.
And It's a Sin, for example, all of those. I mean, a really stellar production company and really great executive producer, Nicola Schindler. And then it got greenlit about 3 or 4 years ago, and then it goes into development. And the whole process was really collaborative. I mean, not every writer will say that, because once you've optioned and you've kind of given over your rights, that's often it. But they were really great. Every stage I was included. Doesn't mean that everything you say and all the notes you give are taken on board, but it means that, you know, you are respected and acknowledged. And so it was great. And then, you know, finally just getting the rushes for the first time and, you know, stellar cast, BBC prime time on a Sunday. I mean, you know, it's a bucket list moment for sure. And also really exposing, though, because my book was never a particularly creative or commercial success, really. And actually, you then go from that to this big machinery of the BBC, where it was a big production for them. They had a massive PR team. You know, it was quite exposing in many ways.
So your new book, Permission, is very far removed, really, from the road. Can you tell us about this book and the genesis of the idea?
Well, I wanted to just explore the idea of people in a long-term relationship, not young people who kind of perhaps are more non-monogamous by generationally the differences now, but a couple that had kids and baggage and had reached a certain point where they really loved each other, but maybe they wanted to go on a bit of an adventure. And in this particular instance, having sex outside the marriage was going to be the adventure. And that's what I wanted to explore.
What kind of research did you have to do for this book?
Well, I didn't personally have to do any research. If you ask me whether it's based on a true story, it's not. I read a lot. I mean, it's, you know, there's so many podcasts now and so much literature around consensual non-monogamy. But actually, it's in the end, you know, having done so much research for Ridley Road, the joy of this was actually I could imagine quite easily how those, and I had a very clear idea of the story. It took me a lot less time to write than Ridley Road, and I knew where I wanted it to go. So, and then I guess other stuff came up within it that you just end up fleshing out and exploring.
And was there anything that really surprised you that you found out about this kind of non-monogamy, especially in kind of adult life, that surprised you?
I don't think so, actually. I think actually what I felt was pretty much confirmed. I mean, I think it's a challenging thing to do. And I, you know, obviously I wrote a book that has quite a lot of jeopardy in it to make it an engaging read. If you were to be really strict about following all the rules that you set, I mean, lots of people have rules, you know, and you have to have some sort of understanding of what your arrangement is. If you were to, and there's lots of communication, there's lots of chat between partners. This is what you read about. And that's really boring. So obviously I didn't really want to write just a kind of mirror of the perfect arrangement. Lots of people make it work. I think it's hard. I think jealousy is probably, as I expected, one of the biggest concerns, you know, to be faced with. And also, you know, as I try to explore, can you really separate sex from that emotional connection? And it's the emotional connection that perhaps is going to in some way unravel, you know, your relationship. It's a risky thing, you know.
Absolutely. What's been your experience of this book being published? It's out with Legend Press, which is one of the bigger independent publishers.
Yeah. They've been great. I mean, you know, they've been really collaborative, really engaged, really lovely editor who I knew before. Yeah, really good.
So you said that one of the reasons you moved to Brighton was to write more. I'd love to know about how you feel about being part of Brighton's writing community and where you get inspiration from the city.
So I'm part of a bigger thing, and I know a lot of writers in Brighton. I'd say that I've got two writer friends that I met locally when Ridley Road was published, and they are my, you know, actually three, and they are my sort of go-tos. And we definitely have a sort of both a very good friendship as well as a sort of writing connection. And you need that, you know. And then inspiration, I think for me, it's got to be the sea. You know, I love the sea. It's the reason I moved here more than anywhere else. But I think, you know, we're so lucky to be sandwiched between the sea and the downs, because I've got a dog and I can go everywhere and, you know, all of those things. But also, it's, you know, Brighton is a place, I think, where everyone just gets to be who they want to be. You know, it's, you walk along the street and you see all these people, you just think they're just who they want to be. And that's it. That's very inspiring. It's quite freeing, I think, after being brought up and living in London.
And what are you working on next, Jo?
I will probably turn my hand more to working on some TV stuff, really, than a novel. That's where my interest lies at the moment.
And how can we find and follow you?
I have a website, jobloom.com, and I'm on Instagram as Jo R. Bloom Author, although I'm not very active. Social media isn't really my thing, so.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our book club book this month is The Final Revival of Opal and Nev by Dawnie Walton. I thought this book was extraordinary and one of my favourites of the year. It's told as non-fiction, but it's actually fiction. It's a novel. And I kept finding myself Googling the characters and events in this book, only to find out that these people and events don't exist, although they are definitely based on the kind of cultural times that it was set in. Here is a reminder of the blurb. A queen of punk before her time, a duo on the brink of stardom, a night that will define their story forever. Opal is a fiercely independent young woman, pushing back against the grain in her style and attitude, a black punk artist before her time. Despite her unconventional looks, Opal believes she can be a star. So when the aspiring British singer-songwriter Neville Charles discovers her one night, she takes him up on his offer to make rock music together. In early 70s New York City, just as she's finding her niche as a part of a flamboyant and funky creative scene, a rival band signed to her label brandishes a Confederate flag at a promotional concert. Opal's bold protest and the violence that ensues set off a chain of events that will not only change the lives of those she loves, but also be a deadly reminder that repercussions are always harsher for women, especially black women, who dare to speak their truth. Decades later, as Opal considers a 2016 reunion with Nev, music journalist Sunny S. Shelton seizes the chance to curate an oral history about her idols. Sunny thought she knew most of the stories leading up to the cult duo's most politicised chapter, but as her interviews dig deeper, a nasty new allegation from an unexpected source threatens everything. Provocative and haunting, The Final Revival of Opal and Nev introduces a bold new voice in contemporary fiction and a heroine the likes of which we have not seen in storytelling. So unfortunately, due to writing commitments, Dawnie Walton couldn't make it onto the show to talk about the book, so I took the liberty of looking up some interviews with her and picked out some of the most interesting things she said about writing this book. When asked what it was like to develop Opal and Nev as complementary characters, she said, "Back in 2013, I was watching footage from Talking Heads' concert movie Stop Making Sense from 1984. At one point, singer David Byrne, in the middle of the stage, behind his weird self in the grey boxy suit. Then the camera pans and you see his backup singers, two black women whose names I've since learned are Lynn Mabry and Edna Holt. They were giving it their all, so talented, so compelling, and wearing micro braids and bright red lipstick and grey short suits to match Burns. I thought, God, I wish I could pull one of them to centre stage." It sparked a bunch of what if questions. To friends, I pitched the novel as, imagine if David Bowie and Grace Jones made proto-punk music in 1970s New York City. What would that be like? I started riffing from there.
I began with Opal's voice, thinking about the city where she lived, Detroit, which was, at the time of her childhood, a place of wonderful empowerment and resistance for black people. I wanted Nev to come from a different socio-economic background. He's a funny one. He ended up surprising me often. As I was getting to know his voice, I thought of him as charming, but also a little slick, in the way that a celebrity would be. I was also thinking about his privilege in this context and what the idea of certain rock stars being chameleons would ultimately mean for him. Danielle Evans in the Washington Post wrote about this book, how wonderful it is to watch Walton build that complexity, starting with Opal's fraught music industry debut. Opal arrives in New York facing the skepticism of the label executive who had hoped Nev would choose her buxom and more conventionally attractive sister Pearl as his vocal partner. Opal is skinny and dark-skinned and, because of alopecia, spent her childhood being taunted by kids who called her baldy. She's never been taught to read music and doesn't know much about the world she's entering, but she knows she wanted out of her old life, and that's all the motivation she needs. With the help of her stylist, Virgil, who sees her unusual looks as a canvas for otherworldly drama, and Jimmy, her drummer and lover, who teaches her how to hear and adapt their music, she becomes a bolder, more authoritative presence. Opal is justifiably touchy when asked repeatedly about that confidence. I understand what people are really trying to ask me. Is this? Is what she said. How in the world did a woman so black and so ugly manage to believe she could be somebody? I love this take on the book, and I really loved the characters. I think an oral history is such an amazing way to tell a story. There's a really extensive cast of characters, but you never get lost with who's talking because the voices are so strong and so assured. I especially loved the relationship between Opal and Sunny, who is the journalist kind of telling this story, but also Opal and her stylist and best friend Virgil. It's absolutely beautifully written and completely compelling. I was so bereft to have finished this book. It was definitely one of my highlights of 2022's reading. It's fresh, interesting, gripping, and the perfect read to start the new year, especially if you're someone that really likes non-fiction and really wants to kind of get into reading more fiction. And if you're someone that reads a lot of fiction like me and not enough non-fiction, really, it was a really good way to kind of get back into that style. So I really can't think of anyone who loves books, especially people who love music, that this would not appeal to. Thank you very much for listening. Our next episode is our Valentine's, or anti-Valentine's if you like, special, where we will speak to four authors of romance books: Julia Boggio, Charlotte Rickson, Sarah Jafari, and Joseph Murray. Our book club book is Jessica George's highly anticipated debut novel, Mame, which is out in January. Happy New Year, happy reading, and we'll be back at the end of the month.